a question flitted through the young man's mind. What's a good-looking girl like you doing killing a guy like me? The year is 2042, when the old and feeble outnumber the young and productive, and volunteers are called heroic for cooperation with the ominous Youth Initiative in order to free up dwindling resources for more able-bodied citizens. Such is a future reality envisioned by Dr. James Dobson in his new novel, co-authored with Kurt Bruner, called Fatherless.
Really, I'm seeing changes that have not occurred in my lifetime. And the unrest, I think, is certain to increase. And if you look 30 years into the future, that's what pops up.
Warning signs point to a world turned upside down, a future none of us would ever wish on our children or their children, if they even have any. In a foreboding cautionary tale set 30 years from now, the long-term impact of falling fertility and an aging population has created a dark world. But as Kurt Bruner points out, there is reason for hope.
People will read these novels and realize, yes, it's getting darker and darker, but I, right now, today, can love my spouse, can nurture my children, can pour into my grandchildren, and realize that it's the creation of those bright spots that will over time dissipate the darkness that's rising.
What can happen to humanity in a society where growing up with the protective love of a father becomes the exception rather than the norm? That's what Dr. James Dobson and Kurt Bruner ask and depict in Fatherless.
Despair is not what is needed right now, but discernment and willingness to address the problems and the issues that we face, and at least recognizing them and understanding them.
Coming up, a discussion about an entertaining trilogy of novels by these two well-known authors. Welcome to this special one-hour radio presentation with Dr. James Dobson, Kurt Bruner, and Chris Fabry, talking about Dr. Dobson's and Kurt Bruner's new novel, Fatherless. This is the first of three books aimed at providing entertaining stories while addressing the disturbing trends we see all around us today. Dr. James Dobson is the founder and president of Family Talk in Colorado Springs, Colorado, and radio host of Family Talk with Dr. James Dobson. He's the author of more than 30 books on the preservation of the family that have touched the lives of millions. Kurt Bruner is the author of more than a dozen books. A former vice president at Focus on the Family, he serves as pastor of spiritual formation at Lake Point Church in Rockwall, Texas, and on the adjunct faculty of Dallas Theological Seminary. Kurt is also president of Home Point Incorporated, helping local church leaders create a culture of intentional families. Here's our host, Chris Fabry, with Dr. James Dobson and Kurt Bruner, as they talk about their book, Fatherless, the first novel in their new fiction trilogy.
Dr. Dobson, Kurt, welcome to the program. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you, Chris. I always enjoy working with you.
Thanks for the honor.
Dr. Dobson, the first question I have is the dedication to Fatherless. It's to Chuck Colson. Why?
Well, because both Kurt and I greatly admired Chuck Colson. He was one of my closest friends, and he just had a way of perceiving the culture from the perspective of Scripture, and as such, he had just great influence on me through the years. It reminded me a lot of my dad, although we weren't that farther apart in age, and I miss him greatly today. I just wish Chuck knew and could review the work that we're doing in this trilogy. I know he would have some great insight for us.
Kurt, anything to add to that?
Well, I would only add that Chuck Colson was part of a generation of leaders who foresaw many of the things that we depict in these novels coming and started giving early warning signs. We hope by dedicating it to Chuck Colson, we in some ways honor an effort he put decades into, and that is saying, hey, evil is evil, but the good can overcome.
So Fatherless is the first in this trilogy then. What are we going to see coming next?
Fatherless is the first of three. The second book, which will come out about 8 or 9 months later, is called Childless, and the third book is called Godless. Now, all three of them are set in a world in which this dramatic drop in fertility and dramatic rise in the average age of the population and all the economic tension that creates, all three stories are told in light of that reality and those trends. Each individual book has a different sub-theme. So with Fatherless, you're experiencing, what does the world look like when having a father in the home is actually the exception rather than the norm? In fact, just recently, a news report came out saying we've hit the lowest fertility rate on record in the United States. And of those children who are born, 40% of them are born to unwed mothers. So those trends, what does that look like as you look out into the future? That's Fatherless. Childless deals with, more specifically, this theme of what happens in a world where maternity is no longer valued, where sex becomes more a plaything and a game and is decoupled from and detached from the beauty of motherhood and maternity and childbearing. And then Godless is rooted in that theme, again, from the great Dostoevsky, who said, if there is no God, all things are permissible. And what does that look like, and how does this play out in a world that we've depicted?
Well, just about everybody knows, Doctor, that your heart beats loudly with such a passion for the family and all of those issues. You've written best-selling books on discipline and bringing up boys and girls and marriage and just about every aspect of the family that you can think of. There must be a good reason why you want to tell a story that's set 30 years in the future.
Well, really what we're writing is that the three books project the institution of the family three decades into the future based on today's demographics. And they're just irrefutable. Everything that has been stable for hundreds of years is now unraveling at an alarming rate. And the institution of marriage is one of them. It's likely to be redefined to include same-sex relationships. And that hasn't happened in 5,000 years as a general thing. Children will be subjected to stresses and influences that will change the growing up process. Religious liberty is under assault, and who knows what spiritual upheaval is coming. So, in short, life as we know it is in the process of changing radically, and someone should stop and think through, what does this mean 30 years hence? And I guess Kurt and I have elected ourselves to do that.
Kurt, let's talk about the power of a story, the power of identifying with this character that, you know, is on the page and kind of jumps off the page. What can that do for good or ill for the person who's reading?
Well, you know, we live in story, don't we? Our whole existence is because God, the grand author of the grand drama, has put us in scenes, in a particular scene, in a particular time, in a great narrative that's unfolding, of which he's the author. And we know that ultimately the end of that story is one of redemption. But there are also very, very dark scenes. There are also very troubling moments and disturbing moments. And in every great story, there's conflict. There's good, there's evil, there's redemption, there's love, you know, the guy, will he get the girl? And all of those things play out in all great stories. And the reason we're excited about portraying what's coming, what the trends are telling us is coming, in story form, and throughout history, literature has been a powerful tool in depicting realities, depicting trends, depicting themes that are inherent in the gospel. And that's what we try to do here. It can be something as simple as Charles Dickens, who wrote A Christmas Carol. And you remember the ghost of Christmas past, present, and future, all of which points to that process of repentance in his life, which is a Christian theme. Or Victor Hugo's Les Miserables, which is about grace versus the law. Dostoevsky, who wrote about the fact that if there is no God, then all things are permissible. So literature has always been a powerful mechanism for capturing the heart as well as relaying profound spiritual truths.
It can also be used for the bad of the reader as well. Not that you can't paint a dark picture. There have been a lot of writers who've done that over the years and have shown us the logical end of some bad choices. I think of Madame Bovary and others. but it can also be used to entice and to draw in and lead you down a path that you shouldn't go.
Well, it can, and there's been a lot of literature of late that has done that, particularly as it relates to our sexuality, isn't it? In fact, in the last year or so, one of the best-selling series of all times was a series that is very, very disturbing in terms of how it dehumanizes women, in terms of how it treats sexuality as and our intimacy between husband and wife, between man and woman, treats it as a game rather than as a life-giving beauty. And when we depict those things in this series, and there's a lot of romance and there's a lot of picturing of romantic love and the relationship between man and woman, when it's ugly, it's because it's being done according to that which God did not intend. But when it's done according to God's design, it's very, very beautiful and needs to be depicted that way in great story.
Dr. Dobson, take me back to your childhood or formative years. Was there ever a story that grabbed you that you felt like you, as you were reading it, you were living it?
If you don't mind, let me answer it a different way, and then I'll answer the one you're posing now.
Okay, sure.
All right. The most influential person who ever lived, of course, was Jesus when he walked the dusty streets of ancient Jerusalem and Galilee. And how he did that conveyed his truths to as many as 5,000 people at a time. And what did he do? He told stories. He told parables. And who knows how he actually told them? You know, he described, for example, a dirty, miserable pauper named Lazarus who was hungry and needy, and the dogs were licking his sores. And he crawled past an open door where someone, I guess the servants, had set a lavish table, and it was falling over the side and falling to the floor, and the dogs were lapping it up. And Lazarus said, "If only I could have a few morsels that are falling to the floor." And you can imagine how the people were moved by this gripping story. Now, when it's reduced to writing, even in the scripture, we don't really know how that story was told, but Jesus told one after another, and people were deeply affected by those stories. I believe now that a story, a good story, especially one that's true, has the opportunity to get through to the hearts of people. And in this case, novels have been chosen for the process, and I think it will be very useful.
Was there ever a novel in your childhood or growing up years that you felt that about, that you were just, as you were reading, you were just immersed in it?
Well, I was greatly influenced by fiction when I was in college. I've focused my life on nonfiction since then because that's what I write. In fact, this this effort to communicate through fiction is my first venture into that genre, if you will. But yes, I took great books classes in college, and I was greatly influenced by Steinbeck and so many other the great authors, especially English literature. And those things really had an impact on me. This is why, Chris, that I speak in stories. If you just look at my first film series and the one we're working on now and what I do on the radio, it's largely reduced to stories because that carries meaning.
Kurt, follow up on that. Do you recall being immersed, getting into a story like that in your childhood or formative years?
Oh, absolutely. In fact, I'm a huge fan of Tolkien's Lord of the Rings by way of example, and Dostoevsky's books on Russian culture and such. They've had a huge impact, and I'll tell you why. It's not simply because you're reading an idea. It's because you're experiencing those ideas embodied in human reality. And I think that's the power of those kind of books, and I hope that's the power of what people will experience in these novels.
What then is the audience? Who are you trying to reach with these stories?
Well, I think any adult who can understand what's at stake in this nation and in Western nations and indeed around the world and why the changes we're seeing right now should be understood and maybe a difference made while there's still time.
Well, we hope to reach a couple of different audiences. One is just anyone who loves a great story, anyone who's drawn to thrillers, perhaps novels that are thrillers or romance, all of those different genres of literature. I will say it's not for children, despite my background and Dr. Dobson's background with telling stories that are more appropriate for children. These books would probably be rated PG or PG-13 in terms of some of the themes. There's some very disturbing themes. There's some very beautiful themes, but handled in such a way that they're really more appropriate for adults.
Because of what types of themes, then? Where do you go that's PG-13?
Well, for example, it's a dark world because it's a world where human life has become devalued to the degree that there's something called the transition industry. A major theme of these stories is the fact that the population decline has created such an economic crisis because fertility has dropped so far, and the aging population is creating such a financial burden on the young that it's become heroic and considered something to be the highest sacrifice to volunteer to die so that your resources can be transitioned, we call it, to the young. And so it's a world that has disturbing themes. That's one of the reasons I would say it's probably more PG or PG-13. But also we portray the beauty of marital intimacy in such a way that, readers have found beautiful and yet not necessarily appropriate for young children.
Yeah. Kurt, a lot of our listeners will know about the Hunger Games. They've heard about this from their children. They've seen it all in the media. And this term dystopian comes up, and people wonder, what does that mean? Can you define dystopian and then comment on the comparisons to books like 1984 and A Brave New World and The Hunger Games?
Sure. Well, let me start by saying, what is a utopian? Utopian books and stories are those that portray a future that's idyllic and perfect and almost heavenly. And it's often used to portray what we wish could be. Dystopian literature, which is actually far more engaging to read and far more popular, dystopian is the opposite. It's showing the horrors or the disturbing qualities of what our future may look like in light of present-day trends. And so when you see books such as you mentioned, The Hunger Games or Brave New World, you're kind of experiencing that Ghost of Christmas Future dynamic where Scrooge, if you recall, was brought to a scene where he's looking at the future based on what's currently happening. And he says, oh, is this the future that must be, or is this the future that only could be? Could I change it if I do the right thing now? And dystopian literature kind of does that. It kind of calls us to look at where we're heading in light of the present trends and the present realities and brings us back to today to say, now, how will I live differently today in light of what I've seen could be on the horizon?
So take us into what each day looks like. What is everyday life like? Is there urban unrest that people are going through?
The primary overarching crisis of this series is an economic crisis, again, because of the depopulation, dramatic drop in fertility, and then the rise in the aging population. Perhaps the best way to picture that is a tension that exists within the characters, particularly one of the families, the main families, which is Kevin Tolbert and his wife Angie, and that they're considered something called breeders. And that's a derisive term in the future, almost like a racial slur today, where the population and the intellectually and cultural elite look down their noses at this group of people who devote themselves to lifelong marriage and raising children. If you're going to have children, for heaven's sakes, don't have more than one sensible child, maybe one, two at the most. But, oh my goodness, this family has three children. And one of those children, as the story unfolds, you'll see they've discovered has a disability. And they're in a world in which disabilities are very uncommon because people don't just simply have children the way they do today or have historically throughout all of human history, and that is conceive out of passion and love for your spouse. Children are conceived in the clinic. There's a very clear line and a distinction between having children and making love in the future. And so there's that separation that creates a world in which people pre-screen which child will or won't be born. And so these breeders who kind of believe in having children by faith and by what they would call chance are considered irresponsible in that future world.
So from a parental perspective, boy, I'm all over that. I mean, my wife and I have 9 children, so we would stick out like a sore thumb in 30 years. What about growing up in that kind of environment for kids? What's that like for them?
Well, we don't have to work too hard to imagine what it's like to grow up in a world where one, or at the most, 2 children is the expected norm. Take China, for example, which has now been living for several decades with something called the one-child policy. Recent news reports are coming out. In fact, I heard a story not too long ago where the divorce rate has risen dramatically in China. And as they've tried to figure out why, because it's a culture that's traditionally highly valued the permanence of marriage, they're finding that it's probably related to this one-child policy. Well, why would that be? Well, what they're finding is these children all have grown up in homes in which they're the center of their parents' universe and therefore become the center of their own universes and aren't used to compromising, aren't used to apologizing, aren't used to doing any of those things that, as you know, siblings kind of create in one another's life in terms of forming you into that image of Christ that's humble and that's all of those things. So imagine a world in which you have fewer and fewer children, all, as P.D. James put it, when you treat children as gods, they eventually behave like demons. And so you have all of these people who are used to being the center of the universe. So that's one of the effects on children. But for those who are raising children, for those who do value that gift of children in the next generation, they will feel largely dismissed. They will feel less cherished by the world around them because, again, they have that stigma of being part of that breeder culture that is despised in that generation.
You're listening to a conversation between our host, Chris Fabry, and his special guests, Dr. James Dobson and Kurt Bruner, co-authors of their first work of fiction, a gripping novel called Fatherless. That title points to a possible future world where the nurturing protection of a loving father has become the exception rather than the rule, and a world in which the choices of our generation creates an economic crisis for the next. More information about this new trilogy is available at fatherlessworld.com. That's fatherlessworld.com. We'll be right back after this. Welcome back to our special one-hour radio presentation with Dr. James Dobson, Kurt Bruner, and Chris Fabry as they discuss what went into creating a riveting story set 30 years from now. The first volume in a brand new fiction trilogy that presents a serious warning to us all. The dedication in this book is written to the memory of the late Chuck Colson, who foresaw and warned about the ominous trends depicted in Dr. Dobson's and Kurt Bruner's new novel called Fatherless.
Let's talk about the economic realities that are in this story 30 years in the future. What's America like? Is it still the United States of America in 30 years? Doctor, you first.
Well, I really wish I didn't have to say it, but this nation is divided today. There's hatred between the haves and the have-nots. Maybe that's overstated in the press, but it certainly exists. Spiritual warfare is tearing into the fabric of Western cultures. There's urban unrest, and it's growing. I'm seeing changes that have not occurred in my lifetime. And the unrest, I think, is certain to increase. And if you look 30 years into the future, that's what pops up.
Let me add to that a couple of very specific things that are portrayed in the book. First of all, something we call the Youth Initiative. In a world with a dramatically and rapidly aging population and all the economic burden that that places on the young, you have the national leaders calling for a youth initiative, which sounds so wonderful until you realize what they're doing is the fiscal conservatives who really have jettisoned concern about the sanctity and dignity of life or the beauty of marriage and the family. These fiscal conservatives are driving a utilitarian view of humanity that says, listen, if you're old or disabled or unable to contribute or carry your load, then really really, you should volunteer yourself to be eliminated so that we can leverage your assets for the young and the healthy and the productive. Well, and you can see it in headlines every day. We pay attention to these things. Recent Telegraph.